did as the central effort. And I'm hoping that we can take some of the language from that document and carry it forward and make sure there's more intention. It was great to hear the neighborhoods speak out and say they'd like to have beaches and better access to the Willamette. Really want to emphasize that hopefully you guys will take the opportunity to read over the comments that we made, and so that over the last 11 years, there's been seven planning efforts over the last 11 years related to the Willamette River. So the question is, why aren't these things happening? Why aren't there greater access? This is an opportunity to put some concrete things in this document that will hopefully allow that to happen. And there is a lot of talk about habitat in regards to the Willamette, which is awesome. But I would suggest that should coincide with access for people, because if there's not a corresponding amount of access as there is to habitat, then less enlightened people might just trample through these areas. As it is right now, swimming is occurring in downtown Portland actively. I mean, people are swimming off the light boat dock on the south side of the Hawthorne Bridge and the north side of the fire boat dock. They're at Audrey McCall Beach. It's happening now. So I would also emphasize that one last point is that there was a quote that said that Parks doesn't officially have a plan to address swimming, paraphrasing, and when they get a chance to do it, they'll do it. I mean, I would just say that this is happening, and there's a certain responsibility that comes with cleaning up a river to the point that you can swim in it. And one of those things is creating safe avenues for people to get into the river. So there's a lot of communication that says it's safe to get into the river, but there's no direction about how to get into it safely, and that's really important. So thanks again for looking at my comments.
Yeah, do please submit those in writing, too, because as the council deliberates on the document and suggested wording changes or additions, for that matter, we want to get those from you when you can, please.
Great. Yeah, thank you very much.
Welcome.
Yes, Ken Clock. And I guess I'm not a polished speaker, but I have some thoughts and some feelings from industrial manufacturer in the southeast area. I think there's a disconnect at the moment in the sense that a planner earlier in this meeting said that the southeast industrial area is successful in its own right today, and we want to protect that. And yet, a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to another manufacturer there, and he said flat out to me, the city doesn't want us here. So I guess it doesn't really quite gel. A lot of folks have put a lot of time into this plan, and it recently received a unanimous recommendation from the Portland Planning Commission, though to be sure, those involved to date have a vested interest in the plan. I have a manufacturing business in Southeast Industrial Sanctuary. My family has operated this business in several locations in Southeast since the 1950s. I've read the plan, it's a large document, and I've looked at the maps and the renderings, and there are a lot of good intentions there. When studying the plan, I can't escape the feeling that what I'm being told seems slightly disingenuous based on what I see. I'm told that the plan will support and strengthen the growth of existing industrial business. What I see is a considerably reduced industrial area. In fact, I see islands of industrial area that will be completely surrounded by planned housing. I am told that truck freight will move more efficiently. In fact, I see new bikeways, bike lane barriers encroaching on already diminished industrial streets, as well as a green loop three blocks wide that extends from the Banfield Freeway on the north to Division Street on the south, effectively splitting the industrial area in half and further hindering industry traffic. I'm told that the plan will support and strengthen the growth of industrial existing businesses. In fact, I see major challenges for any industrial business attempting to remain here. There will be complaints from new housing residents from the plan, despite the so-called disclosure waivers that they are to sign, and the city will be left to sort these complaints out. A tremendous emphasis in the plan revolves around dedicated and encroaching bike lanes and pedestrian access, and these are not compatible with industrial traffic that is moving efficiently. And it would only increase the danger for all of us. That means everybody in the whole area. The plan has many pretty renderings that I call the ghost of Southeast future. It has lofty headings advising me, advancing equity, it could be like Sunday, parks every day, and imagine. The reality is, I can't imagine an existing industrial business surviving this plan. While I'm not foolish enough to think that my testimony here actually matters, there are some basic facts that need to be addressed. May I continue?
Yeah, briefly, please keep going because I'm going to have a couple questions for you.
35 years ago, the city proclaimed Southeast Industrial Sanctuary and invited industry here. Our business stayed, many more came, and seemingly it was a good relationship. But now we aren't. Now we really find out that we're not your child, we're actually a stepchild. It is a very slippery slope to consciously dilute industry in this area while trying not to dilute it too much. There are things that you don't know and honestly could never know about Southeast industry. What depth of interaction the businesses have here, what binds them together here, what encourages them to stay, what will make them leave? There's a critical mass of business required in order for industry to thrive. Other businesses you manufacture for, that manufacture for you, that provide local services or purchase materials from, there is also a critical efficiency required, whereby local businesses rely on unencumbered local street system in order to back trucks in to unload, load out, send employees out to pick up local supplies, parts, etc., and all in a timely manner. When critical mass or critical efficiently cease to exist, an industry business will relocate elsewhere, again decreasing critical mass. As I said, there are things that you do not know about Southeast industry, things that you can never understand. They're not in a book anywhere. They're dynamic. Even if you can't fully extend it, understand Southeast industry, you should attempt it. And even more importantly, allow for it. Unless, of course, what I'm being told in the plan is really an illusion.
Hey, well, I guess let me make a request instead of asking a question. It's not our intention to adopt an illusion. We're trying to deliberately adopt a plan.
I understand so that.
My request, I guess, for you, you've probably already done this, but I guess I'd ask you to do it more, is to turn around and get together with Debbie Kitchen, who chairs the Central Eastside Industrial Council, and tell us what amendments you want to see in this plan to get the future that you want, because it's not our intention to chase industry away. And so, you know, the planning, this committee of your peers and the staff have worked all these months to try to get to that point. It's an earnest effort. They may have not gotten it right, but there was nothing disingenuous about it. So now it's time to get down to words on the page and colors on the map for us over the next year of exactly what zoning should be there. And as I said earlier, I have been of two minds about whether this overlay for employment should be on the industrial zoned blocks or not. My jury is still out on that question, even though there's a recommendation. If you think we shouldn't apply the EOS overlay to the whole district, say so. And you know, that's something the council needs to hear. I guess the other thing, I don't know if you've been here in the last few years, because I don't remember if you have, sorry. But lots of times this council will have one citizen come in and say something useful and we'll change something. And we'll do it here too. So don't feel like you said something about you're not sure if your testimony would matter. Believe me, if you came here often, you would see that happen often, where one citizen comes in and says something cogent and we say, wow, that's new, and we change a document or a plan or a decision. So this is not a done deal. It is a recommendation. It's a recommendation that obviously has a lot of agreement behind it, so that has some weight. But if you have some suggestions for how we defend and maintain existing industry in the district, we want to hear them. And again, I would recommend, just for purposes of time, rather than you and I wonking out on which box should be which zoning, is spend some time with Debbie, who's the chair of your district, and say, we need this.
Well, my family's had a business there since the late 50s, and I've been working there for 45 years, and I'm 64 years old. I've never been to city council meeting yet in my life, and I've never been in this building.
Ah, well, welcome, and we hope you come back. And again, I'm serious about this. If you've got suggestions that you want us to change in this document,
well,
you know,
I think
there's still time.
I think the overriding thing is if you're serious about protecting the industrial area that's there now, everything that is done there has to be balanced with that question above it.
Mm-hmm.
Does this protect industry in this area that we already have?
What's the name of your business?
Clock Associates.
Pardon me?
Clock Associates.
You have do you have some daughters who work with you?
I have had a daughter that's worked with me. Yeah.
I thought you were here once testifying, but anyway, I echo what the mayor says.
Yeah, we'd be interested in hearing. You know, let us know what you think we should change, because it's a proposal. We're not simply here to rubber stamp something.
That would be my suggestion. Okay. Everything needs to be prefaced with that, if you're serious.
We are. Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Kelly Roy, the owner of ADX and a member of Portland Made. Thanks for all of your work on this plan and all the staff's work on this plan. I think you're aware from some of our previous testimony that Portland Made represents over 200 makers and manufacturers. Of the 100 members that were surveyed last year, they create over 1,000 jobs and over $270 million in economic activity. And our membership has multiplied by 5 times just in the last year. So if you do the numbers, 5,000 jobs, $1 billion in economic activity. And we believe that our membership doesn't capture everything that's being made here in our amazing city. So I'm here to represent what is called the maker movement and makers. And we consider the definition of makers as people who make physical goods. They're not software developers in technology, and despite the desire of technology to be in the warehouses in the Central East Side, we need that valuable infrastructure for this growing movement in our city. They provide valuable working class, middle class jobs, and those are the types of jobs that I'd like to see the city support. We did a survey of our members, and there's a need for over 150,000 square feet of additional space for manufacturing, and they're unable to find it in the Central East Side, primarily because of real estate values being driven up, and a lot of the manufacturing space is being converted to creative office. So in that vein, we're very concerned about the employment overlay, and we actually think there should be an expansion of industrial zoning to accommodate more makers and more manufacturers because this movement is growing. So what's the maker movement? It's the legions of artisans and craftspeople and entrepreneurs and doers who are reinventing and reshaping artisanal manufacturing one handmade product at a time. Is the people who are starting businesses, developing products, honing their skills, and offering support and sharing tools and knowledge with each other. The maker movement is gaining momentum across the globe, and everyone is looking to Portland to uncover the who, what, why, and how of this critical resurgence in artisanal manufacturing. As the founder and owner of ADX, I've had the good fortune to be at the helm of this extraordinary movement. I'm actually in the midst of writing a book, which I've given you information about. So the book will be written not only about the long history of manufacturing that we have in our city, but the next generation of manufacturers who are in the Central East Side and in need of this space. So the amendment that was put in front of you that was from me and ADX was crafted by Troy Doss, and it is a good start. However, it isn't comprehensive. We need a full inventory of existing warehouses in the Central East Side. We need an inventory of the makers and manufacturers, including the number of employees that they employ, the revenue that they generate, whether they own or rent their buildings, and the amount of growth they're experiencing. Because in our surveys, we see nothing but rapid growth, increase in employment, and increases in revenue for the city. And then we also need the tools that we can use to protect and preserve the warehousing and manufacturing space in perpetuity, because it's a critical part of our local economy. So we're looking forward to working with you and staff to uncover some of those tools, but we think that the overlay zoning is a very dangerous road to go down, and it will put a lot of pressure and put a threat on Portland's growing maker movement, which is really gaining international attention.
So are you two in agreement about this?
Well, I think so. But let me pose the same question back to you that I posed to Mr. Mawson, and that is, let me play his argument back and get you to respond. He made essentially a supply side argument, if you will, that if we apply the EOS overlay to the whole district, more of the vacant properties will get developed. Some of the vacant properties will get developed as creative office, and that will take some of the pressure off the remaining buildings that are used for manufacturing. Do you not believe that?
I don't see any studies that back that up. Maybe it would be helpful to engage someone like Joe Courtwright to do an economic analysis to see if that plays out. I did not see that play out in the Pearl District. I've been in Portland for over 20
Pearl
years.
Pearl District got zoned CX. I mean, that's a different story. So the question is rather here, which strategy best preserves affordable space for makers? I think there's no one in the room that doesn't want to do that.
Right.
Well, maybe there is, but we don't. we want to preserve affordable space for makers. But I'm hearing two arguments. One is hang on to what you've got. If Steve was here, he would tell us who did that song. Just hang on to what you've got. And therefore, keep that industrial zoning. Don't have the EOS overlay on those buildings. And that will give the makers and manufacturers a chance to hang on because they won't get outcompeted. The opposite argument is those spaces are already getting bid up and that the best way to keep them is to release the pressure elsewhere. You're right. It's an economic question.
It's an economic question, and I don't think we have the answer. I think what we need to do first and foremost is make sure that we protect this really valuable investment that we've made as a city. That, you know, manufacturing infrastructure does not come cheap. The amount of electrical distribution that's required, the amount of plumbing and air lines that are required, it's really hard to do that in new development and keep your costs affordable. So that's why we're requesting an inventory of existing warehouses, existing businesses, because these businesses are already being pushed out of the district, and we're losing those valuable warehouses to tech companies that want to use them as office spaces. So it's a really... it's a real opportunity that we have to do a comprehensive inventory. And I know this plan has been going on for 2 years, but this movement has been rapidly growing in the past 2 years. So, and it's continuing on that trajectory. So we're just looking for those creative mechanisms for protecting and preserving industrial uses, again, to support working class jobs. You know, a lot of tech jobs are not working class jobs, middle class jobs. We're really... big proponents of supporting people who don't necessarily go to college and need employment opportunities, and manufacturing and this movement provide those types of jobs, and so we want to see that protected.
Ellie, let's assume we had the inventory. Can you give us a preview of what some of those tools are? And I know your handout alludes to at least... co-op model and some strategies for actually acquiring and holding. We're pretty prescriptive around here when we talk about anti-displacement, anti-gentrification. We do that at the front end now, but we're very prescriptive. This is a little loosey-goosey. So what are the tools we're talking about, and what are the actual tools for which we have funding to implement?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, there are other people struggling with this in San Francisco and in New York. There's a handout that I gave to you about commercial land trusts that are being formed, commercial co-ops that are being formed. But we can take some hints from land trusts and land banks. We want to protect wildlands. There are mechanisms that we can put in place. And so I think we can look to some of those tools that are out there and apply them to industrial land. I think they're just now starting to be applied in that way in different cities around the country. We were fortunate enough to be a part of a national roundtable at the White House where cities from around the country were providing best practices, and many of those are in hot markets, hot real estate markets. So we're available to help with the research, come up with the tools, but we think that protecting and preserving needs to come first, and then we figure out the zoning that allows for the development of vacant land and whatnot after that. But
and you would anticipate a substantial amount of public funds to lubricate this effort to acquire and land bank?
I think it could be a combination of public and private funding, just like we've got a lot of examples around the city where public sector and private sector come together around things that we value as a city, affordable housing being one of them. So I think we just apply some of the similar tools, but to industrial land.
Just one other question. If there was, if your worst fear was realized and there was displacement, where are makers likely to go?
Well, we see a number of makers and manufacturers have been pushed over to the Northwest Industrial District. We have seen some makers get pushed out to the suburbs, but then try to come back to the Central East Side. But we would certainly lose them in our city and all of the employees that come with it. I consider the people that are making these kind of artisanal goods a huge part of our culture as a city. They're artists first and foremost who have figured out how to develop a business and a manufacturing company out of that business. They're investing a lot of money and a lot of resources in the buildings in the Central East Side. So, you know, I imagine they'd go to Oregon City, Gresham, other industrial areas outside of the city. But I think as many people have pointed out in previous testimonies, this is a really valuable thing that we have in our central city, and it's perfectly timed with this movement where there's a huge demand for industrial space. So we have kind of what we have existing and this opportunity to expand upon it. Another big opportunity is to make everything more visible, doing factory tours, showing the general public what's being made in our district, from Gamblin Art Paint to Grove Made, iPhone cases, to fashion lines like Make It Good and Nell and Mary, to food products like Olympic Provisions and distilleries. All of these are kind of manufactured items and they need manufacturing infrastructure, so it's a really rich mix of businesses. But I would just say that the threat of this creative office use that the office overlay or employment overlay allows for more of just takes a lot of these cool warehouses out of production, and that would be a huge loss for our city.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you all.
So I apologize. I have to leave. I have a family commitment.
So I think we can continue for a while with the three of us, and the two of our colleagues can review the record. So let's keep going.
The next three are Brad Molson, Mike Redman, and Jose Gonzalez. And they'll be followed by Sarah Tunstall, Dana Hinger, and John Bollier.
Good afternoon. Go ahead, Brad.
Thank you, Mayor and City Council. I won't take very long, but I think I'm going to change what I was going to say. But first of all, I want to thank BPS and for all the effort and all the people who volunteered on this on the Southeast Quadrant Plan. There's a lot of people who are passionate about the city and passionate about what happens. And I guess I want to comment about the past and the future. And I think really, I think there is an evolution going on in the Central East Side as well as the greater city. As opposed to a revolution, and we know that there are districts that have quickly changed from one to another. Pearl is a great example. But I think what Kelly's referring to is the makers. There are a lot of makers who there's an absolute explosion of people designing and making things with 3D printers that occurs in more of the office setting. So I think there's really kind of a really interesting blend between industry of the past and industry of the future, and I think what Kelly tries to preserve is absolutely necessary, and we should pay attention to that. But I don't think we still need to pay attention to where the future is and where these creative design jobs, these small manufacturing jobs are. And it's we see these in all of our buildings. I think the most important thing I want to say about the Central East Side in particular is that we don't want to close the door on a lot of the opportunities coming there and a lot of the kind of creative firms coming there. And if you think back 10 years ago, Jonathan has pointed out to this many times that we didn't even know what an app was 10 years ago. And now apps run a lot of things. What will it be in another 10 years? So in our desire to look at what the future is, we have to keep the door open as much as we can. At the same time, we need to pay attention to the legacy businesses, the industrial businesses, including Mike over there, who we've arm wrestled many times about, and listened to him, and good friend. And I think coming from New York, I've watched this evolution happen where you get the changes going on in districts and neighborhoods and how they conflict and how they orchestrate and how they do this very interesting tap dance between businesses and residential and new types of businesses. I think it's just part of the evolution of the district. So the plan is great. I think the most important part is that people work to find the areas of compromise. We paid attention to trying to protect the businesses. We paid attention to trying to protect the makers. We paid attention to trying to predict what the future needs are going to be and to try to find some way of addressing most of these concerns. So thank you very much for the time. And
Brad,
yeah.
One thing about this process that's been striking to me is that despite the strong feelings throughout, we're at a moment where there is some consensus, grudging consensus.
Yes.
Maybe in some cases, the best kind of consensus, because no one's particularly happy. But since the mayor raised the question, I want to pose it to you. What is the consequence if we scale back significantly the proposed expansion of the EOS?
You know, I don't know. I just feel that there is a certain amount of, there's an egalitarian kind of approach to people in the district want to be able to have uniformity, have consistency, have the ability to improve their buildings. A lot of these buildings and a lot of the buildings that Kelly's referring to require a lot of upgrade to make them work. So that's part of the city has, I mean, this, some of the things we could certainly address is how we deal with seismic, how we deal with improvements, what triggers the expenses, and so I think that I would hate to shut the door, especially when all the stars are aligned right now. Interest rates are still low. More incredible number of business and individuals want to start businesses here. The Central East Side seems like one of those places where we invite people to live out their dreams a little bit.
Yeah. I won't respond to that, but I want to flag something for Commissioner Fish and Commissioner Saltzman. I think this discussion is a preview of some other discussions that we're going to have in the comp plan, and that is, in order to get the outcome that we want, the future that we want, the shaping of this huge wave of growth in the way we want, are we going to be more directive or more permissive than the plan has been in the past? For example, in a housing context, and Susan and I have been talking about this, right now you can build row houses in R2.5. Sometimes that happens. We might want in this plan to say you will build row houses in this zone. We haven't done that before. We've just said you could build row houses, you could build apartments, you could build, you know, and that's kind of this issue. That if we say, if we want traditional industry, do we say that's what we want here? Or do we allow the market, as you just articulated, that's been more of the Portland approach, is to allow the market to figure it out. The CXD zone downtown, you could build a hotel next door, you could build an office building next door, you could build a housing project next door. We care a lot about the design, and we'll regulate your floor area and your density. So it's a big philosophical planning question that's going to really get to be serious on several fronts in this plan, and maybe this is the first real clear iteration of that for the council, even having already looked at the West Quadrant. I think this is raising that issue of, are we going to be very specific, or are we going to let the market play a broad role? And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, but there is a choice.
Well, Mayor, in light of that comment, is it your intention to potentially propose more amendments between now and the next hearing?
Yes, not necessarily my intention, but certainly to allow them. Thank you. Jose, welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Commissioners. My name is Jose Gonzalez. I'm executive director and founder of Milagro, and I'm honored to represent the CEID Creatives, a coalition of arts and culture organizations and practitioners, artisans, and makers who have a vested interest in the future of the Central Eastside Industrial District. In May, CEID Creatives testified to the Planning and Sustainability Commission regarding concerns we had on a number of issues impacting work, affordability, environmental health, public safety, and visibility for arts and cultural activity in the area. There were some strong results coming from that meeting. One was our willingness to collaborate with the city and other bodies in addressing these issues, as well as to contribute to the aesthetic plans for the area. And the revelation, thanks to Commissioner Oxman, that arts and culture is only briefly discussed in the COMP, Southeast Quadrant, and Central City concept plans. These few mentions would seem to indicate that arts, culture, and creative activities have not been seriously addressed with much depth or adequate representation from the creative community. We can do better. For this session, we have submitted a list of process and action recommendations gathered through a series of public meetings and shared with members of the Central Eastside Industrial Council, of which we are also a member, CEID Creatives, and other interested parties. These recommendations continue and expand upon those presented before the Planning and Sustainability Commission. We envision a thriving, flourishing, creatively infused neighborhood, one that serves to elevate Portland's position as one of the leading cities in the nation for creative and maker activity. And we support the Southeast Quadrant Plan, even though it's not fully formed, but are committed to working to seeing that realized in conjunction with the other plans of the city. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor Yelsman. I'm Creative Woodworking, Michael Redmond. I've been here in Southeast Industrial Area for 35 years. I started in 82. I started in 1,000 feet. I was a maker. I grew into a city block. And that's kind of some of what we hope some of these makers will end up doing, is that they'll incubate something, and then they'll be able to grow into their art and their craft of what they do. One of the strongest things that we are advocating for is we industrial businesses in the Central Eastside Industrial District need to have the same freight priority that we started with. We need that secured. I think you're going to see a lot of things fall into place naturally if you keep this in place. But I'm getting ticketed right now, so there's a contradiction. And this can be fixed real easy. So if we can just keep that, then you're going to see these people stay. You're going to see me stay. And you're going to see people come into the district because they can get their freight in and they can get their freight out. And please, don't make us get a permit. I never had to have a permit before. Other industrial districts don't have a permit. That would be awesome. I can just see that working. We need to be able to load and unload in the street like we always have. And that's exactly primarily what I'm saying, okay? Now, I was told by the permit department I can't have a permit on Taylor. I have two doors on Taylor. I can't have a permit on Salmon. I have two doors on Salmon. That's what your guy said to me. So can we fix this, please? Then we'll stay. And I think the reason you're hearing some people say that we are being forced out, I've never heard anybody say that they want us to leave. And I can't say that we're being forced out. But as I get cut 1,000 times by a parking meter guy, it feels that way. That can be fixed really easy. So we're in an IG1 zone. Troy, thank you for keeping it that way. Thank you for all the work that's been done. And they did listen to us because we were at all the meetings. I brought my kids. I got four kids that are taking over my business. They work there. My daughter's 18. She testified here when we tried to keep the street at the width it was. But it is what it is, and we're working with Andersons, and they're doing a great job. So I think we can survive that construction next door. But with that being said, please give us some teeth to work. Don't let anybody complain when they move next door to an industrial zone. You guys could fix that. You know where you moved. Everybody else is happy. That one guy that's not happy, he gets nowhere. And move back out to the country or something.
Can I just clarify something?
Yes.
We have lots of powers, but we actually don't have the power to prevent someone from complaining.
Well, I mean, they can't legally make me move, though.
If you have an insight into that, I would want to get a consultation. It would help me in my marriage and with my two teenage children. But
you are a man.
Just a little insight on that. I mean, it's late. We've been here a long day. We actually have a lot of people come before us who live in the Pearl, for example, who say that there's too much noise from the bar that's in the building below
but they move
them
there
or something. And from time to time, we have these discussions about what is it to live in a dense urban area. And when you bought your place, were you aware that there was a grocery store around the corner and the like? But so we can't actually ban people from kvetching. But I get your point that we can make sure that people understand that there are certain uses which are allowed.
There.
And with that comes accommodations. And you're going to get a little more noise or something.
Here.
So consider that, or maybe get double pane glass. Or
yes, and I think that in they're building a quieter next to a border of an IG1. But the fact is that the disclosures you're coming up with, just given it strong understanding that you know where you moved, there's a bar there. You don't like it. We're not going to make the bar move. But you did make the church stop ringing its bell. You are considering a lot of these other things. Somehow these people get heard, and then the church can't ring its bell no more. And I don't understand that. So anyway, if you could help us.
I hope we never did that.
I don't know who did that, but it did happen in Northwest. So, and then the issue with the trucking is the bikes. Okay, so I don't have a problem with the salmon being a bike lane. The only problem I have is if they have priority over my unloading. We were there first. I was told to move there. Troy zoned it, IG1. Oh, no, I mean, everybody's understanding that we want to keep this way. So can we somehow get a priority so we can all work together, love each other? I'll move as soon as I can and let you by, but you don't have priority. You came into my district. Please, consider that. And keeping us there, that'll keep us there. I don't have to move. They tried to come and buy my building and move me to Northwest Industrial District. I tried to make it work. It can't work right now. You know, I can't make it work. I can't afford the move, even with the costs as high as they are. So, again, that's our only problem. So I really love what you guys are doing, and I think Kelly's issues can be solved. We work for all the ADX people. They go to ADX, they learn how to do something, they come down to us, and we professionally help them take it further. And I've been working for Brad for 20 years. And
by the way, can I just say what you just said about the bikes and the traffic?
Priority.
Well, my son and I took a bike ride through your neighborhood over the weekend, and I guess I'm sorry Steve's not here because there's some questions I'd like to put to PBOT about how we square Vision Zero safety and then these priority uses.
Yeah.
Because, for example, the city from time to time encourages people to go off a main thoroughfare, go on a low-impact road, because it's safer.
Yeah.
So we map it, and we stripe it.
I like
and
it.
And we say, better to be there than to be on a high-traffic zone. So this may be a philosophical question, or maybe it's worthy of a bigger conversation, but does Vision Zero compel us to create a level playing field in places where we understand that one use is less useful and there are greater risks? Or does Vision Zero require us to be more creative about finding a protected route so that bikes, which are always getting the short end of this, right, because they're exposed as opposed to someone surrounded by 3,000 pounds of whatever, are encouraged to take a safer route? And that, as you mentioned this, I'm thinking, I'm not sure why are we even prioritizing one or the other? Why aren't we saying one is a basically a truck route and find a place that's safer for bikes because we don't want to create those conflicts? Because we know who usually gets the short end of a conflict like that. And I don't know that Vision Zero compels us to put a square peg through a round hole, but that's a conversation I think we should have.
Yeah,
I would hope that we would go back to when we grew up and we were told that we had to look both ways before we crossed the street. And yet today, a biker is told that he has absolute priority and he isn't looking out for himself like he could be. So I think we go back to education, and then I really don't believe you're going to stop the bikers from going down the road they want to go, and I don't have a problem with that. And I don't want to say that I don't want them on salmon. I would like to try to make it work with everybody and look at reality, human reality. They're going to cross. They're going to go. And I would just like them to understand that like there could be signage that could say that you're entering into an industrial zone. Red painted stripe signs that say, this is a dangerous area. Go ahead, proceed without, let's educate them, proceed with caution. How about a win-win? Bring your boys on by. Would that work if there was a caution? Could it, Nick?
Maybe so, but let's not continue that discussion now, but I'm glad you got it on the table.
You've got our full attention.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You.
Thank you all very much. Okay, let's take the next.
Next three are Sarah Tunstall, Dana Hinger, and John Bollier. And they'll be followed by Mike Leftinich.
I think we're going to lose a quorum after this panel, so we might have to continue after that. So
Dana's not with us, so if there's another person we can add.
All right, who's the third? Who's the next person? I'm sorry.
Mike Leftinich.
Is he still here?
Mike here.
Mike here.
How about Tom Rocca, R-O-C-C-A?
Okay. Oh, Mike is here. All right, come on up, please. Well, we'll take the four of you, and then I think we're going to have to continue after that because we're going to lose a quorum.
Mayor, can I just, is there someone from the Pellet family here?
I don't think so.
I was hoping to put a question on the record about the park that's being proposed.
Right. Maybe we're going to continue the hearing. We might want to ask them specifically to come. So, Sarah, why don't you go next?
So I'm Sarah Tunstall, co-owner of Spooltown. We're a small-run sewing factory in Southeast Industrial, and we work with 80 to 100 different clients in a year. I just want to tell you the story of Spooltown a little bit, how we got into the building that we're in and what we sort of see as the future of this plan. I think you all have done a lot of really wonderful work, and I commend you on that. My main concern is with the employment overlay and what that would mean to a new startup small manufacturing business. So Spooltown started 4 years ago. And we started in a building of a business that we spun off from and moved into the Central East Side 2 years ago. And we really landed in the building that we were in kind of really fortuitously and by the generosity of the building owners who are, you know, blue-collar bootstrappers. And they recognized that that's what we were doing with our business and wanted to sort of give us a hand in growing our business. And I think it's one of the real reasons that we were able to get into a 5,000-square-foot warehouse in Inner Southeast that really needed no work to it, and we could just move right in. It had all the power that we needed. It had compressed air lines run to it. It had electrical drops for all of our machines. All of those things were really critical to us. They're things that would have been extremely expensive for us in a new build, and so we needed that kind of old warehouse space to be able to move into. And so my main concern is that the employment overlay would directly pit us against tech companies competing for the same spaces. My feeling is that there's no way that we could afford the same spaces that those tech companies can afford. I think that Skip Newberry, who was up here earlier talking about that, was really getting to the point of why those warehouses are really interesting to tech companies. There's kind of a gritty industrial feel there, which is great. It's super cool, but it is also necessary for running a manufacturing business. And those warehouses already exist, and I think it's pretty critical that we protect them and are able to maintain them for startup businesses. I think that, you know, when I started Spooltown 4 years ago, it felt like it would be difficult to start that business. I feel like it would be really difficult now. I think that if we were competing against the same, you know, tech companies for the same buildings, I don't know if we would be able to have a business that now, you know, employs 18 different people and is growing 40% a year. I'll just leave it open for questions.
Thank you. Well, sure. That's pretty clear. So, I mean, you obviously are in the camp that believes, and again, we're having this debate here among ourselves, but the council as well. It's better to protect that space, in your opinion, by not allowing competition for that building.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm glad you made that observation too, what you just said, because I was struck when I asked Skip to list the three factors that they were compelling. His first one was aesthetics, and your first one is functionality.
Totally. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, over and over we think about what would happen if we couldn't be in the building that we're in. You were, you know, talking to Kelly about that a little bit earlier, and where would we go? And I think that it's a critical thing for Portland to consider as we grow is where can you have a factory if the only people who are in those factories are tech companies and they're manufacturing software. It's not the same as manufacturing a physical product, and there are real logistical requirements for that, and they already exist. The infrastructure is already there in these warehouse spaces. Seems silly to waste the money to try and rebuild that and to try and do it at a cost that I don't think that we could afford.
Thank you. Well said. John, welcome.
Thank you. Mayor Hales, City Councilman. My name is John Belier. I am the past CEO of Stacy & Whitbeck and currently chairman of the board. Our company has an office on the inner southeast side, and I live on the southeast side. I'm here today to talk about the infamous Amendment 4 that you've heard so much about today, so I'll be very brief. I know we've already talked about it quite a bit. I think all I'd like to say is that we did propose that language, but it came because the work that had been done, we thought that, you know, overall, I mean, we support the recommended draft plan as presented, and particularly we strongly support the recommendations of the plan to include the Clinton Triangle in the Central East Side. We are the large property owner there on the Clinton Triangle. And it's just ironic that, you know, 2 years ago, nobody was really paying attention to that property. And we've worked with the city and the other bureaus about ideas to reshape that area. And so the idea of going without the master plan, perhaps, and of course with your approval, if that should be accepted, was just something we were following out of the Conway development idea. So I think, you know, sitting here today, listening to other public comments that have been made, if it comes down to that you want a master plan, then that's certainly something we would follow through with. It would add time to it, of course, and in the, you know, in any business world or any development world, time is, you know, interest rates are low, as Brad said earlier, and we'd like to be on the forefront instead of on the tail of a development opportunity. But if that's what's required, then we'll do it. We have had a lot of interaction with the city already on the property there. We've come a long ways. I don't think, the idea of low-income housing, I'm not going to say it was my idea, but it was one of the ideas that I brought to the table before I heard anybody else mention it. And I'm still a big proponent of it. I think it's a great concept for that area. And it's just, it's a fascinating piece of property that, like I said, has gone overlooked for a long time. And whatever comes out of Amendment 4, if we were successful in crafting a better language, then that would be great. That's all I have to say.
Well, your situation is a little peculiar, and it merits more discussion, I think, between you and the council and the bureau, and that is when we talk about OMSI or Conway or the Blanchard site or the post office,
right.
Talking about a single property owner. In the case of the Clinton Triangle, we're talking about you, the city of Portland, and actually three or four other people, right, because there's some small parcels in there as well.
Right.
So who does the master plan? I don't know the answer to that question. So we ought to talk that through and understand that when we say, to Conway, you must do a master plan, they can plan for their own property. So can OMSI. Obviously, it would be a little absurd for us to require you to plan for our property right. with a master plan. So I'm not quite sure how this gets resolved. I appreciate your flexibility. This is a different situation than those others.
Okay.
I will say that your piece of property has gotten more attention from this council than any other piece of property in the city of Portland. So I'm delighted. On some level, I'm delighted to actually have you here talking about it because it seems to be the third hearing or fourth hearing where it's come up. And it has some special magical power, apparently. But the Fourth Amendment that has not been yet put on the table, but what we're debating, does in the amended language suggests that if there's a clear vision, now you mentioned a moment ago that affordable housing could be a portion of it, but if we dispense with the requirement of a master plan in the event there's a clear vision that's been embraced and comes to us for approval, do you have a sense of what that vision could be?
Because there are a number of issues.
What do we put this way? What is your vision for the property?
I think the simpler pieces to say, you know, listing in order, it would be affordable housing number one, commercial and some residential in that order. The property itself, we own the small triangle that's jammed up against Powell and the railroad, and the city owns the beautiful piece of property on the frontage roads. There's utilities in the way, there's not good access at Powell and 12th. I mean, there's just a lot of issues to decide before anybody can really come together with a cohesive plan. Everybody keeps asking us for a plan, but there's a lot of unknowns out there to be discussed, vetted, and decided. And once those are worked out, then the plan, I think, becomes much easier to do.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi. This one?
That's fine.
I actually have a one-page handout. Was I supposed to submit that earlier?
Sure, you can just give that to Carla. She'll give them to us. Thank you.
So I'm Mike Letnich, and I am a business and property owner. And I wanted to talk about the Green Loop and specifically the bridge over Interstate 84. However, before getting to that, I would like to say that I do support the EOS overlay. No one wants condo towers, but this overlay seems like the just right evolution for the district. So regarding the Green Loop and the bridge, I think a lot of people are in favor of the Green Loop, so this might be a little bit redundant. But I've given you a handout that's an aerial photograph that was taken in 2007, and it shows the property that we manage, highlighted in yellow, and the two potential bridge locations. As a reference, highlighted in pink is where the Hassalo development is happening in the Lloyd District. We have about a dozen tenants that work in our buildings. They are a mixture, I think, a really good diversity of what the Central East Side is all about right now. We have software, we have photography, film production, and design build shops, and one of our business is also a design build business. We moved there 15 years ago and sort of became accidental developers just because we were lonely because all the buildings were vacant around us. We have roughly 300 to 400 jobs, depending on seasonality, just in the two buildings. And I want to say that roughly a quarter of those ride their bikes to work. All the bikes are stored in vertical racks inside the tenant spaces, and I figure at least 80, maybe 100 cars are not shoehorned into the streets of the Central East Side because of that. I think that we would have more commuting by bike if bike infrastructure is improved. Sure, there are diehards that will ride on busy streets with average visibility, but most people aren't going to do it if it doesn't look and feel safe. Portland is known as bike-friendly, but other cities are passing this up because they realize that it attracts young, smart people, the lifeblood of a city's future. I hesitated to say this, but I did live in New York for 4 years, from 07 to 11 when we were trying to start an East Coast office. And I actually commuted from Brooklyn to Manhattan daily. And I want to say that the infrastructure there has improved really quickly. There's protected lines and protected lanes and cycle tracks all over now. And that's kind of the competition that I think Portland's having with bike friendliness. Anyway, our buildings are at the south side of the proposed bridge. The city and the planning department have our full support. This is a vital underpinning and catalyst to the whole Green Loop. And we hope that it's not just in the 20-year plan, but the 5-year plan. We do realize this is an expensive investment, but so are parking garages, and in a way, so is Portland's reputation as a place where it's nice to live and work.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Well, again, I'm sorry, I think we're going to lose a quorum here, so I'm sorry we're going to have to continue this hearing. Let's take a moment, if we can, and make sure when we know that is. I think it's July 29th.
Was there an amendment to number 4 that was drafted by staff?
I think if we're going to a second hearing.
Yeah, we'll have time to look at amendments.
They'll have time to bring that.
Thank you very much. Thanks, John. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you, Sarah. So, yeah, I think we should make sure we know when we're going to continue the hearing, too. So July 29th at 2 p.m., does that work? Okay, so again, for those of you that signed up today, obviously you'll remain signed up. Sorry that you were not able to speak today, but we'll take you first if you're here on the 29th. And we'll continue both the public hearing and then get to council discussion of potential amendments. If, by the way, those of you who haven't gotten a chance to speak yet are still here, I'll give you the same request that I did to the folks that were here, and that is if you have suggested language changes or additions or deletions or anything else, do try to get those to us in writing in advance, and that way the staff can prepare a matrix of potential amendments that the council can consider. It doesn't mean we can't consider something new that day, but it just helps keep the work organized. So if you can get recommended amendments to us in advance by getting those to the Planning Bureau, I assume to Troy Doss's attention, then the rest of us will be better prepared then.
Mayor, so, can I add a comment to that?
Please.
It's one thing that's clear to me from today is that there's kind of a delicate balance in terms of the package that's been presented to us, and I'm getting a sense that everything's connected, as John Muir would say. So we're talking about potential changes to this plan, but it we're going to have people cheer us and boo us depending on where they are and how they view the world. So What I would ask, in addition to any amendments we have from the community that to be considered, if there are any substantial amendments with respect to EOS overlay or anything else, I would hope that we would get those at least a week before the hearing, so that we also have a chance to pick up the phone and call Susan and say, "Help! Could Joe come over and give us a little briefing, or could the team come over and give us a briefing?" Because I think, particularly if we're going to be making a decision at the next hearing, I would really benefit from the chance to get your feedback ahead of the hearing. So, thank you.
And I guess one more reminder, and that is this plan is adopted by resolution. It's instructions for the Planning Bureau as they continue the process of updating our proposed comprehensive plan. So actually none of this goes into effect in terms of zoning until the final comp plan document is approved by the council. We're trying through this quadrant planning effort to resolve the policy and strategy issues at the front end, and then get the zoning map to conform with all those previous decisions. But nobody's zoning actually changes as a result of the vote that we'll take probably on the 29th. All right, thank you all very much. We're recessed until tomorrow at 2 p.m.